WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If they ever get around to giving out a Medal of Honor for rock and roll, it's a pretty safe bet that Lenny Kaye would be among the first to receive one. That's how rock critic Billy Altman once described critic, musician, and producer Lenny Kaye. As the guitarist for the Patti Smith Group, Kaye played on some of the most influential rock records of the 70s. His credentials as a producer date back to 1971, when he compiled an anthology called Nuggets that documented the garage bands of the late 60s. More recently, he produced Suzanne Vega's first record. Kaye oversaw Elektra Records' retrospective reissue series, and now he's produced a new anthology celebrating Elektra's 40th anniversary. It's an unusual collection in which performers who currently record for Elektra play songs from earlier Elektra records. The result is musicians sometimes paying homage to music that influenced them, other times performing tunes that are way outside of their typical repertoire. The rapper Shinehead does his version of Josh White's novelty folk ballad One Meatball. Experimentalists Wayne Horvitz, Robin Holcomb, and Bill Frisell reinterpret Bob Dylan's Going, Going, Gone. And the heavy metal band Faster Pussycat does Carly Simon's pop hit You're So Vain. Responsible for matching Faster Pussycat, which is a kind of metal band, with Carly Simon's You're So Vain.
We thought that Carly really deserved to be rocked up a little bit. My only suggestion to that when we came up with it was that they might want to do the song in the first person, but they didn't take it seriously.
How did you come up with the concept for this new anniversary record, The Rubaiyat?
Well, I actually can't take credit for the concept that originated with Bob Krasnow, who's Elektra's chairman at this point. He felt that one of the best ways to celebrate a birthday is not nostalgically or completely looking backwards, but seeing the past through the eyes of the present. And so he decided that it would be a nice way to light the candles on the birthday cake by having the current artist of Elektra cover hits of Elektra's past.
Did you match up the bands with the groups or the songs that they covered?
Yeah, it was kind of a cooperative venture between myself, the bands, and the various A&Rs. We would sit around and think up great classic matchmaking. Sometimes the bands themselves had an idea of who they wanted covered. I know, for instance, Billy Bragg, as soon as he heard about the project, requested to do Arthur Lee in Love. And sometimes the bands didn't quite have an idea of the scope of Elektra's 40 years, and so then it would be my job to make up cassettes of various things I thought might appeal to them and send it their way, and then they'd let me know what they thought, and we'd kind of work out something from there.
Is there a match that you made that you're particularly proud of?
I think the Gypsy Kings doing Hotel California is a hoot and a half, and the one that I feel really good about is Kronos Quartet doing Television's Marquee Moon.
The Gypsy Kings one is a favorite of mine. I think they have this real knack for taking songs I'd like to never hear again, and just investing this like sincerity in it and really making it work.
Well, I think that track especially works because California certainly has some Espanol roots, and I think they really brought out the kind of movement of culture from, Columbus's day, around Baja California.
Now, the Gypsy Kings are actually a gypsy guitar band. I don't think they speak English, and if they do, it's not very well. Did they have to learn the English lyrics?
Yeah, well, actually, they only do Welcome to the Hotel California. Such right, a yeah. lovely place.
The accents are all in the wrong syllables. And yeah. All this. Yeah.
I mean, you know, but they actually had one where they even used less English. They had Bienvenido, a Hotel California. But they wanted to kind of get across as much as possible. I actually am curious what their lyrics translate, because, you know, things get lost in the translation or gained, as it were. So I wonder what they're actually saying.
De una vela y nuestra del camino, soy vos el corredor y yo te dije diciendo: Welcome to the Hotel California, such a lovely place, such a lovely place. Welcome to the Hotel California, such a lovely place, such a lovely place.
You have a long history with Elektra Records. What did the label mean to you when you were coming of age?
It really helped me understand the possibilities within rock music when I was kind of getting my feet wet as a young animal in New Jersey. It helped show me that you could have the depth and integrity of art within the exquisite trash of rock and roll. And groups like The Doors, the MC5, the Stooges were really central to the kinds of music that I would attempt to make when I attempted to make it.
Guitarist and record producer and songwriter Lenny Kaye is my guest. And his latest project is an anniversary, 40th anniversary album for Elektra Records. One of the projects that you did for Elektra, and this dates back to 1971, was Nuggets. And this anthology was subtitled Original Artifacts from the First Psychedelic Era, 1965 to 68. This was a collection of singles by groups who basically were known for one hit. What was your concept? The original concept?
The original concept, as given to me by Jack Holzman at the time, was I think he had just gotten one of the first cassette players, and he wanted to cut his record collection down, so his thought was to do an album composed of those cuts from albums that only had one good cut, so he could put them all on one album. And so he gave me the project, and I was kind of a self-styled rock revolutionary at the time, not listening to anybody and trying to make things as lunatic as possible. So I just kind of wrote down a list of 40 or 50 of my favorite songs at the time I was working at Village Oldies in New York. But they seemed to be all kind of local bands, something I've always appreciated and think is really the heartbeat of rock and roll. And kind of music that was not quite psychedelic. That's why I call it the first psychedelic era. It wasn't quite the progressive rock of the Grateful Dead or Quicksilver Messenger Service, but it was certainly not your 3-minute pop melodies. And he just let me run with it. I'm forever grateful, and I'm also kind of amazed that the record has lived as long as it did, because it was just kind of an oldies album.
Do you have a favorite on here? I want to play something from the record.
I think Pushing Too Hard really captures the spirit that would, you know, a few years later turn into punk rock.
The attitude toward these records when you put it out? I think it was a period when a lot of pop was really being looked down on because there weren't, you know, long and often pretentious guitar solos going on. It didn't have the kind of artistic pretensions that rock had taken on by 1971 when you were producing Nuggets.
Well, I think, you know, it helped to write the balance. I'm a big fan of balance in music. I don't like when things are completely one way or the other. I think when that happens, you have to show another side, because human beings are very complex individuals and have many different ways of listening to music. I think if music was all frivolous and fun at the time, maybe I would have put out a record that emphasized symphonic arrangements and, many musics clustered in one, art rock and all of the above. And I think in the early 70s, certainly a balance needed to be adjusted in terms of providing an alternative to a rock and roll that was not only very professional in many of its ways, but also very sterile and somewhat pompous. And I think Nuggets tried to kind of show that one of the reasons that rock and roll came was this outburst of energy that seemed almost anarchic in its conception.
You used to work in a record store in the Village, in New York's Greenwich Village, called Village Oldies.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to me a little bit about record store culture. I've had a lot of friends over the years who work in record stores, and half the people, or more than half the people in record stores, are musicians or obsessive compulsive listeners to music, and a lot of the clientele is like that too, and it could be a pretty interesting place. It could also be a pretty depressing place.
It is interesting you bring this up, because I found when I worked at Village Oldies, and I am a record collector, and I realize sometimes that what you're essentially doing through your record collection is creating a social life for yourself that A, you can control, and B, records can be your best friends. At Village Oldies, we would see a lot of people come in whose lives essentially centered around rock and roll, and who received their sustenance from collecting records and filing them. And I found it very touching in some ways. It struck me that that's one of the sweet things about record collecting, is that it is a world, and if you enter it, you can be accepted for what you like to listen to, as opposed to who you are.
You actually met Patti Smith at the record store, didn't you?
Yeah, she would come in. I'd be working on Saturday nights, and we came from somewhat the same area. She was from South Jersey, and I was from Central Jersey, and I spent a lot of summers outside Philly, and we both liked to listen to Jerry Blab with the Geeter, with the Heater, the Boss with the Hot Sauce, broadcasting all you young teenagers. We had a lot of records in common, and so she would come in on Saturday nights, and I'd put them on. We'd do the Bristol Stomp, and we'd hang out, and we were just kind of pals. From that, one night she asked me if I would come play guitar behind one of her poetry readings. She knew I was playing guitar. And I said, sure, and I went and did some abstract expressionism behind some of her poems. And from that little acorn, certainly a big oak tree grew.
Could you play guitar well at that time?
I was actually a little better bass player. I had a good sense of rhythm. I don't think I'd ever played a lead solo ever. It was kind of primitive, but in a sense that worked in my favor, because I had no preconceptions to apply to how to play behind her. What we did was kind of rhythmic and sound effecty, and out of that grew songs and certainly a different way of playing music than if I'd had like a lot of blues licks and immediately, whacked them behind her.
How did the poetry readings develop into you all becoming a rock band?
I think Patti was such a rhythmic reader and very accessible as a poet. And when I first started playing chords behind her, I almost found it easy to pick out, because she would almost sing her poems. She would chant them, and in that kind of way, the music had a chance to kind of grow organically. What we would do was she would do a poem, and we kind of get some kind of rhythmic chordal figure, and we just jam on it. And she would go into these flights, stream of consciousness, and pretty soon, over the course of a month or 2 months or 3 months of playing it, there would be certain moves that we would continue to refer to, little accents, little parts that seemed to develop on their way to being choruses or verses. Especially a lot of the early songs on Horses really grew out of no arrangement or no sense of song structure at all. They were just kind of mood pieces that very, found themselves very naturally. We hardly had to write them. We just had to keep playing them until the songs themselves revealed them to us.
What's an example of a song that started out like that?
Free Money certainly started out as just, a repetitious chord pattern. Gloria was another, little riff piece that all of a sudden, we woke up one day and found that it has parts. It has, beginning and an end and a middle and lots of space to fool around in.
Let's listen to Free Money. And this is from the first Patti Smith album, Horses.
Every night before I go to sleep, find a ticket, win a lottery, scoop the pearls up from the sea, cash them in and buy you all the things you need. Every night before I rest my head, see those dollar bills go swirling at my bed. I know they're stolen, but I don't be bad. I take that money, jet plane, babe. Get you on a high plane to a jet stream and take you through the stratosphere and check out the planet and then take you down deep where it's hot, hot in Arabia, baby. Then cool, cold, you feel the snow and we'll roll, drain, roll, drain, roll, roll, drain, drain. When we're dreaming, when we're dreaming.
Patti Smith with my guest Lenny Kay on guitar. Lenny Kay is also a record producer, and his latest project is The Rubaiyat, which is a double CD 40th anniversary of Elektra album. Elektra is a record company, and this is the current artist on the roster doing the songs of the former artists on the Elektra roster. On the liner notes that you wrote for the Nuggets anthology, mm-hmm. You wrote that these bands exemplified the berserk pleasure that comes with being on stage outrageous. What gave you those kinds of berserk pleasures when you were performing with Patti Smith?
Well, my most berserk pleasure came at the climax of Ain't It Strange when Patti and I would do our little dance. Sometimes she would be the masculine entity and she would skewer me, and sometimes vice versa, accompanied by massive howls of feedback.
Was it terrifying for you when Patti Smith fell off stage and broke her neck? It's the kind of thing that you almost don't think is possible, yet it's happened to people. Do you know what I mean? It seems so improbable.
Well, in the context of the night that it happened, it wasn't improbable. I truly believe that it was the music that pushed her off stage. It happened at that moment in Ain't It Strange when we were, we kind of rose it to a peak of frenzy. And at that time, on a really good night, we would wobble the music. We would start, it would kind of raise to its peak. And then we would start, making it jerk around and get itself dizzy. And that night we were opening for Bob Seger. It was one of the few times we ever opened for somebody. So we had a space on stage about the size of a large plank, and but we really wanted to get this audience of people who really had no idea who we were. We were really working it. We were really there. And I remember at the height of this thing, we got the music and Patti started spinning. We started spinning her with the music. We were really locked, and she just spun right off stage. Hand of God, feel the finger. And I feel that that moment was the real turning point of the Patti Smith Group, where our music moved from one of intense confrontation to almost conciliation. you know. And, you know, that to me is the story of the Patti Smith Group. You begin Horses with Jesus died for somebody's sins but not mine, and you end with Wave with a very sweet tone poem to, you know, a martyred pope. And, you know, that moment in Ain't It Strange on a stage in Tampa, Florida, was when we you know, a certain, you know, it's like the expanding and contracting universe. We expanded out to that moment, and from there on, it was kind of a reconciliation.
When she gave up music, were you ready to leave the band too?
Oh, yeah. The band was done.
It was?
I mean, we had no songs left. We had done everything we set out to do except for maybe make money, but, you know, that's part of being a rock musician. You know, you have to have certain stories about, you know, starving forever. But, you know, the band had really done what it set out to do. The only thing left would have to be a pop band, you know, being a jukebox of your hits, and that was never really the reason why we formed. I think all of us felt like the Patti Smith Group was our 70s movie that began in front of 200 people at St. Mark's Church in the Lower East Side of New York and ended before 70,000 people in Florence, Italy. And, you know, where else could you go but that? We didn't want to see a Jaws 2 or anything. I really do. I have no real sense of loss about the band. I really am happy that we went out with our flags flying.
Are you playing guitar much now?
I've recently, ever since this Electra project finished up, I've been, you know, getting the guitar on and playing in various New Jersey bars under a variety of pseudonyms. I have no sense of direction about this. I don't want a record deal. The music I play has no real category. I play sometimes with these jazz musicians, though the music we play isn't really jazz. It's just, you know, whatever comes out. I'm mostly doing it for the sheer pleasure of it, but also to remember why I did it in the first place and to not get caught up in having to direct it into anything or any, you know, record or, you know, actual artistic concept. I just want to connect with the original sin.
Why do you need a pseudonym to play?
Well, it's not that I'm so extremely famous, but I find that I tend to have no self-consciousness. I mean, it's not really a pseudonym. I just don't tell anybody that I'm in the band. You know? It's like, you know, playing with sunglasses on and stuff. I really, the communion that I'm looking for is really between me and my guitar and to present it to people without any sense of context. I don't want them to say, well, this is what Lenny Kaye is doing now, or who is that guitar player? I just want them to listen to the tone and what I'm playing and see if I can get them like that. Again, I'm trying to do it with as little sense of ego as possible and to remember what the music's about. I think sometimes, especially in these media-driven times, people are very concerned with who's who and who's doing what and are very quick to judge movement. I know one of the lucky things about the Patti Smith Group is that we had a long period of time in which to find ourselves because we had no sense of direction. And essentially what I'm doing now is kind of loosing myself from any of the perimeter or the paraphernalia that the music business, you know, gives you, and just getting back to music itself and seeing what it is I have to say and why I want to say it and, you know, kind of getting an internal loop within myself.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Lenny Kaye is the executive producer of Elektra Records' 40th anniversary compilation, Rubaiyat, which features current Elektra artists doing new interpretations of songs of Elektra artists from the past 40 years. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's another song from the Rubaiyat. This is reggae rapper Shinehead doing the song One Meatball, which was originally recorded by Josh White in 1956.
Man, it wasn't long ago, back in the days, man. Them was some rough times, you know what I'm saying? Wasn't no food.